Verehrte Fahrgäste, willkommen in Salzburg Hauptbahnhof. Ihre nächsten Reisemöglichkeiten.
Maybe you can tell me what was your experience on the islands in Greece about the refugee situation the last month?
When the EU Turkey deal got signed and pretty much implemented immediately, the material conditions on the ground were not there for it to happen. It was just not feasible to do what the deal required, both of Greece and of Turkey. The asylum system there doesn't really deserve the name, and the detention system in Greece was just not up to par. So when the deal was implemented on the 20th, it was an immediate catastrophe everywhere. Police did not know really what to do. They didn't get orders. They didn't get the reinforcement that they needed from Athens, and Greece didn't get the reinforcements it needed from Europe. And the sort of chaos that ensued for the refugees and for the authorities that were trying to deal with them was evident. You could see it immediately from just the demands that were being made in the deal. I was slightly surprised looking at it happen on Chios, how absolutely the chaos overwhelmed everyone. It was really I knew it would not work, but just the sheer monumental catastrophe was something I would not have expected. It was immediate humanitarian problems on a scale that we had not seen on the islands, I think, for a long time. And such a total lack of comprehension on behalf of the police of what to do. This sort of went on in this way. Things got a little bit clearer, but the problems are still going on, and they are multiplying also. Some things are getting fixed just because of, by passage of time, you'll just automatically somehow muddle your way through. But also, just by people being there for a very long time, new problems crop up. So the situation is absolutely not getting better. And just as an example, just before I left Chios a few days ago, the first reception service, which was supposed to be 140 people doing the first screening of people when they arrived and sorting them into vulnerable categories and so on. They were 12 when I left. 12, not 140. And they had quit work in protest.
People are from the...
From the Greek government. It's a Greek government organization. They are supposed to... When people arrive, when they get registered, they are simultaneously supposed to screen them and say if they are in a vulnerable category, and then they should be moved on to the mainland. But they quit out of protest for just lack of reinforcements, because they are absolutely not capable of dealing with anything. And then there are just communications issues between groups, and the local government is not really being involved in any of the decision making, and then local problems happen, but the local government isn't able to respond to them because it's all being run either by Athens or by Brussels. So it's just a complete failure in every human sense. What did work, however, and this is the key thing, and this is what Europe really wanted, it did stop people coming, especially after they started deporting people. Now, they only did it once, really. They only sent people back to Turkey, and that was pretty much all just voluntary returns, or something, it was, formally speaking at least, it was just voluntary returns. So the deal isn't working really on its own terms, because the deportations were supposed to happen much quicker and there was supposed to be much more. What matters to Europe is not really anything other than just people not arriving in Europe, and that has turned out okay for Europe. The casualties of that deal is obviously the hundreds of thousands who are remaining, or the millions who are remaining in Turkey, slaving away on some fields or in some factories. And then the thousands and tens of thousands stuck in Greece at the moment in such catastrophic conditions that you just wouldn't believe it's Europe. It's going to be different than it was last fall and this winter, because all the borders have been reinforced very heavily. And it's not quite certain that people would be allowed to move freely around as much as they were before, and as much as they are now when they get to the mainland. And even on the islands, they are allowed to move around quite freely. It's possible that if Europe really, you know, gets shit scared again, as they were this winter, that they would do something even worse on the in Greece, for example, setting up huge concentration camps. But I don't really know how Europe would respond to this. They seem to be willing to do quite a lot, actually, to close this route. And I you know, fear for the moment when the borders open again to see what they will do next. Because the determination with which they have broken humanitarian law and with which they have disregarded the lives and rights of people is just astounding. In February, or January, February, they were saying in very ominous tones, we have 2 months to save Schengen. And then 2 months passed, and there was no deal or anything on the table. And then they, you know, very quickly created this deal. It was very obviously a last-minute thing before summer came and new arrivals would come in huge numbers. It was very clearly a shit mix on the last minute to just rescue Europe from foreigners. And this is why I think that it's not necessarily thought through. It's not clear that Europe has a response to what if this doesn't work. And they've said themselves there's no plan B. But, well, maybe they will be forced to do a plan B, because they will definitely not allow 3 million refugees getting into Europe. And if Erdogan really wants people to leave Turkey, he will definitely be able to make that happen. It's a frightening thought what Europe will be capable to do and what it considers itself capable to do. I wouldn't want to guess. You know, last winter I was talking with people here about how they would set up these closed camps on the islands and would deport people from there. I don't see any other plausible way of stopping people now than either closing the border with Greece completely and just abandoning it to its own fate, with some hundreds of thousands of refugees stuck inside, or forcing Greece to build huge camps, closed camps, for the refugees coming here. Refugees have been arriving in Greece for a long time, but it really picked up this autumn, and there has been a two-sided struggle. One is the humanitarian aspect of helping people ashore, giving them food and warm, dry clothes and places to sleep before they move on. And the other has been a political thing, which is helping them realize their aims and goals, which is primarily to just get to a safe and economically sound place somewhere where they can restart their lives. And this winter, the humanitarian side has been dominating, especially the media and political discussion, but also, and this has been sort of my main issue, also the volunteer work. So volunteering in Greece has been very heavily identified with humanitarian aims. The problem with looking at the humanitarian side mainly is that there has been a strong, steady push towards closing down the political avenues that refugees have in order to realize their aspirations. The state has been very deliberately, slightly haphazardly, because there has been very bad cooperation about this, but very determinedly, though, to stop refugees coming into the continent. And this is a political aim of the European political class, and it seems to me also of a very large segment of European society, to prevent foreigners from getting into the continent. And focusing on humanitarian problems such as are they getting enough soup or are they getting warm blankets, while their chances of moving on are being closed down is just counterproductive, really. Because, sure, you're helping them for a few days, but what they are looking at is not a few days. They are looking at the rest of their lives, and they want to move on, which is why they are protesting these days with slogans such as, we don't want food, we want open borders. And it's not just in the last 2-3 weeks or 2-3 months, it's this whole winter they've been saying this to us. And all the more they are noticing that the avenues are closing. And, I mean, it's easy to be a humanitarian. Nobody can criticize it, really. Not on its own merits. You know, it's easy to go somewhere and say, I don't want to be political about anything, I just want to help people. But you really have to ask yourself, are you helping someone if they are being held still somewhere against their will? Are you helping them by giving them blankets rather than by, you know, screaming at the people who are stopping them from moving on? Wouldn't it be better to focus your struggle on the people who are making decisions, such as the decisions being made in Brussels these months and these last years, really? Wouldn't it be better to, for everyone, wouldn't that be the real humanitarianism? To broaden your aims and to make it not just about the refugees having a good few days while they're on the islands, but having a good rest of their life. So I think this humanitarianism, it's in a way, it's counterproductive, but it's also just sort of hypocritical, because real humanitarianism would, if you go deep enough, you know, and if you look at it wide, you know, through a wide lens, then you would see that they really don't just want to feel good for you know, while they are traveling. They want to just be able to travel.
There are already a lot of political groups involved, especially from the anarchist side or from the radical left. How the struggle can look like?
Right. So this winter there has been there have been plenty of what I would call anarchist soup kitchens. They sometimes don't want to be called that, but they are definitely working on anti-hierarchical principles and so on, and I'll just go ahead and call them anarchist. They have very good principles, and they really have a good ideology, and impressive when you look at it. The anarchist soup kitchens have a very impressive ideology, and you really see it when you work with them, what a difference it makes to look at refugees as equals and not as you know, charity subjects. It really makes a difference to everyone involved to not degrade yourself or anyone else by your work. So the mindset is clearly, you know, coming from this direction of them, you know, looking at them as human beings and as someone who has rights just as we do, and someone who should be allowed to do things as we are allowed to do. But the tactical thinking has been lacking, and while there has been a sort of at least a subconscious thought of borders closing down, sometimes even a conscious discussion of it, there has not been tactical thought about working against borders. So they have the ideology that everyone should be allowed to move around Europe, even though they are not born there. But then when it comes to actually doing something about it, the work has been more symbolic, which, I mean, it's nice, but it sort of indicates either a, you know, a symbolic action against borders really requires that you have an audience that will exert political pressure for you once you have made that symbol clear. That just hasn't really been happening in Europe. So what you have to do is just think in terms of practical goals. What is it that is stopping people from leaving? Well, first and foremost, at the moment, it's the EU-Turkey deal. The EU-Turkey deal seems like something very big, something that you couldn't have foreseen. But actually, people were already in September talking about, well, you know, in the end, it'll all just be closed camps on the islands where everyone will be deported. We were talking about this very openly, and it would not have taken a lot of thought to see where things were headed. So when the hotspot regime was announced in, I think it was around, you know, the start of the year, then it sort of started to get going. People should just have seen that as the highway to hell, and that should have been stopped very practically and very immediately by everyone involved. Now, the left of the last decades has been extremely unideological when it is organized, or it has been very anti-organizational when it is ideological. So the unions have lost their ideologies, but they are organized. However, the anarchists have ideology, but they are not organizing en masse. So when actions started against hotspots, or when people wanted to do something against hotspots, they only had random phone numbers of some other people they had met in Greece. That is not how you build a political struggle. That is not how you have effect in the world politically. You need to have a very well thought out political organization that is capable of doing concerted action over preferably a wide geographical range. This was just not there when we needed it. If we had it, then we could have directed it against hotspots immediately while they were being built, because if there had been no hotspots, there would not have been an EU-Turkey deal, because it was completely premised on the fact that you could arrest everyone when they arrived. Now, at the moment, it seems to me there are not too many avenues for action. It is sort of symbolic for this lack of practicality or lack of broad-scale practical political thinking on the left, that we have sort of been relying on fascists to protest the hotspots for us and on Erdogan to kill the EU-Turkey deal. These are our main allies at the moment. And that, to me, is just the complete death of a movement, you know, to be defeated on these fronts in this way. But I am really, just at the moment, not really looking at what the left is doing. I am very attentive to every move that is happening in the Turkish political system. And everyone recognizes that is the key to refugee movements in this year. At the moment, it seems possible that the deal will survive for a few more weeks, and then, you know, it is sort of, you know, struggling to breathe at the moment, and it's sort of lying on the ground somewhere, and nobody's really paying attention to it, or not really capable of resuscitating it, and Erdogan is standing above it with a pistol in his hand, waiting. So the deal will be publicly executed by the man in not too many weeks, I think, and then Europe will have the whole crisis again, but will just have more fences in place when it really starts again. If Erdogan is somehow convinced to keep the deal alive, which he can single-handedly, then the whole refugee stream will go to Italy, which will just mean an enormous increase in the number of deaths at sea, because the route is much more dangerous, and horrible conditions on arrival, because, you know, Greece has not been very good at building hotspots, because it's a completely disorganized state, and it isn't really a state, if you not in the Northern European sense. But Italy has sort of managed to build the hotspots, and they are just as horrible as in Greece. But because it sort of has the facade of you know, of a smooth functioning machine, everybody thinks it's sort of more humane. Which again is something that we could see coming. You know, it looks really inhumane and disorganized and bad when refugees are just walking across, you know, across great fields or you know, paddling through the ocean somewhere on a rubber dinghy, but that is the most humane way that Europe has figured out to let things happen, but just not by just leaving them alone or you know. But the more that Europe does about this to try to organize it and bureaucratize it and sort it and systematize it, the more disgusting it becomes to the people who suffer it. And it looks better in some naive sense to have a huge detention camp for everyone with containers, you know, boxes for them to stay in. It really looks like the bureaucrat's dream, but it's disgusting for the people who end up in it. So, again, you know, to recap, the left, radical left in Greece could have done some things this winter. It could and can all the time do some more groundwork in the north, trying to connect people, trying to raise awareness about the political background to this, what has been presented as a humanitarian crisis, but it really is a political crisis. It's both a political crisis in the sense that people are not being allowed through, and it's a political crisis in the sense that when they are getting through, the elites freak out.
And the people as well. I mean, now, especially in Germany or Austria, you have the far right winning ground. And
exactly. Yeah, everything about this crisis has been very badly handled. It also didn't take really a genius to see that you know, when a million refugees get into an extremely xenophobic and historically very solipsistic and narcissistic continent, you would get a knee-jerk reaction against them. Now, the way that the far right has played its cards in Europe these last few years, it's been saying that people who arrive in Europe will take the, you know, few remaining low-paying jobs that we have, and they will take the little that we have left of benefits. and then there will be nothing left for the lower classes of this continent. This is an ingenious argument because it completely directs attention away from the enormous amount of wealth that this continent has, and it has gotten it, just by the way, you know, from plundering the rest of the world for 500 years. What the left should obviously have done in this atmosphere is just say, well, there is just an unprecedented amount of wealth in Europe. It has never been so rich. This continent has never been as rich as it is now, per capita or absolutely. It's just incredibly wealthy. And it doesn't take too much work, if you really put your mind to it, to redistribute it in a way that everybody can have enough, no matter if, you know, 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million refugees come in or not. It doesn't really matter. You know, we're talking about the richest this continent has ever been in the history of the world. It's amazing, really, that the left has not been able to respond more cleverly or sort of holistically than just by saying, you know, well, maybe they will take your jobs, but they have a right to move here. You know, yeah, sure, that's nice, but that's not going to calm anyone down. Nobody cares about the rights of others if your livelihood is at risk. Or, I mean, maybe some do, but it's not a political strategy that you can sell very easily. I don't know where this idea comes from, that the class struggle is somehow over now, because if you just look at the way that wealth is being distributed in the world, it just has never been as sharply divided as it is now, or at least not for, you know, some considerable amount of decades. You know, since the beginning of last century, we may have had the inequality that we have now, but with less wealth in total. We have way more wealth in total now than we did then. It's really a stunning display of a propaganda machine that's really working well, that people are not able to conjure up a more realistic or imaginative scheme about how to run society in the next 50 years than the sort of minor tinkering with you know, small scale fixings of, you know, well, maybe you can build a few more houses for them or something. It's really, you know, pathetic. And the left really, you know, it's I really hope that it can sort of get on its feet again, but it really deserves its current defeat by the way it's playing its cards. It really needs to think a little bit more about what it's doing and you know what large scale problems it's facing. I think what would really be nice to see now would be someone just putting in a little bit of work. This is sort of what I dream of doing if I ever have the time and patience for it. But I know that there is plenty of academics and hard workers who would be capable of doing this. Just to put together a scheme of the way that we could redistribute wealth in Europe, how we could implement it in a way that with refugees coming in from places which are being bombed, how we could stop bombing them, you know, put together just, yeah, you could call it a utopian scheme, and just see if people like it, because people are afraid of it. You really feel it when you start, you know, telling what kind of changes we need to do so that the planet doesn't get screwed over, you know, and completely ruined in 50 years, and how we can sort of manage the migration flows or how we can allow them to happen, you know, so that people don't get bombed to smithereens by the US Army or their weapons. You know, these are big problems, and it takes a big solution for them. It takes an imaginative big leap. And someone needs to put together the framework for it, the realistic program, and I won't you know be able to tell you in a 1 minute segment how I figure that it should happen, and also I would just need a lot more work to do it. But my main concern is that I don't see anyone doing it, and I don't see people talking on this level. I see people talking about how we can implement, you know, tax reform in capitalist society so that maybe, you know, it's maybe that would be some kind of step in the right direction, but you're still leaving everything else just lying around on the floor. You know, you're not thinking about it. It's not a holistic solution to kind of, you know, tinker with the tax system. This is a huge societal problem, which is completely based on small number of, well, more corporations than individuals, really, but small number of entities completely dominating the political discussion and political power in the West. And it takes a mindset that acknowledges that this is a fundamental problem, not a technical problem. It takes a mindset that acknowledges this to be able to sort of work its way out of it. But what we've seen on the left since the end of the Cold War is a left that is completely non-ideological, absolutely technocratic, that really praises and admires, you know, fixing the economic numbers and the tinkering with the tax percentages in such a way that you get to, you know, increase growth a little bit. It's symbolic that in many countries, Iceland is a very good example, the US also in a way, that a sort of reformist left-wing candidate comes on the scene after the great economic crash. And what do they offer? Do they offer a new vision for something? No, they say, you know, for example, Barack Obama, you know, hope we can believe in, or whatever he said, you know, or change. Tsipras. Yeah, Tsipras is another example, you know, but what do they do? They don't have any large-scale economic program. They just have, you know, a toolbox of capitalism where they just sort of crank it up again, get it going again, and on we go with, you know, completely destroying the planet, closing down borders and so on, as we were doing before, as if nothing had changed. We have all the same problems as before, you know, with it. So it's just tragic to look at this and to look at the migration problem now being tackled in exactly the same way. To see it, you know, see that we, yeah, well, you know, even leftists sort of having this idea of, yeah, well, of course the right wing is gonna explode when they come here into the continent. Well, they don't have to. If we just say how we can, if we offer a vision of how we can live together with them and have a better economy for it rather than a worse one, and a better society for it rather than a worse one, it would be sellable. It's the tragedy of the left is also being replicated in the response to the migration crisis, where they instead of offering a vision of how we can work it out, they offer a technocratic analysis of how fascism will inevitably happen and how we can best manage when that goes on, rather than just saying, well, you know, we can allow them to come in, and if we change the way that we think about and work the system, we can also make everyone feel better for them being here and not, you know, create more fights on the bottom. And it's just a lack of vision and a lack of faith in yourself and a lack of confidence of the left that it's not thinking on these terms. And it's a fear of revolutions, it's a fear of large-scale changes, it's a fear of utopianism, which you don't find on the right, because the right wing has all these things. The right wing is not afraid of revolutions, it doesn't call them that, but huge systematic changes are happening from the right, which they can just blithely put forward and implement with no consequences in discussion, except, you know, some whining on the left that, you know, really we should have just left things alone or something. Instead, the left should just pull its act together and just make huge demands in the other direction, huge demands of how we can do things better.
You think this could happen like a left populist utopian way?
I think it has to be, and this is another tragedy of the left. The left has really dug itself into a hole with this one. The leftist project has sort of died because it believes so much in rationalism that it doesn't want to use demagoguery. It doesn't want to speak to the public on emotional terms because they think that is being hypocritical or you know, manipulative. Well, politics has just never happened. You have just never succeeded in politics without at least speaking to people in terms that, you know, they engage with. And you have to be able to inspire people, and you have to be able to give them, you know, a vision of how things. Yeah, you can ground it in reality as opposed to what the right wing does, which is just grounded in, you know, absolute irreality. You can do that, but you do have to admit and you do have to use populist approaches to politics, because what we want is a mass movement. I mean, look at the large what has sort of rekindled a little bit of hope for leftists in the last few years are populist movements. It's Syriza is, for example, a populist movement. Yeah, well, we know how that crash landed. But I will say again, you know, it was a lack of ideology rather than an overabundance of ideology that caused that crash. And Bernie Sanders in the US at the moment is also a populist, very clearly. But he is, at least, yeah, he is also, you know, offering technocratic solutions. What we need is more of this, but more in the direction of the utopian. And yeah, we can do it by the Sanders path if we want to, but it would be nice if there was a unifying ideology behind this, if we had some sort of a coherent narrative and a story of how things got this way and a story of how we want things to be. It's good to remember that when the left made its biggest progress, which was in the Depression and post-World War period, the biggest progress for working people of the Western world was at a time when there was huge political competition from the Soviet Union. And people could say it was a narrative of history that said, workers have taken over there, we can take over here also if you don't give us what we want. It would be good to see some ideological work happening where a large-scale narrative of what is happening in the world gets created. If there is a convincing, inspiring story as to where we are in history and where we are headed, and not, absolutely not, the technocratic and dry and boring fixing capitalism narrative that we're being told at the moment, which nobody believes in.
Termitinitus.org